He hasn't done it yet. He hasn't returned, and that must mean that he still has work for us to do here in the meantime. And in some ways, that's what we're going to be thinking about this evening. In April, in our evening series in Proverbs, we're thinking about the issue of work and our working lives and how we conduct ourselves as Christian in our working lives. We're coming to this book of wisdom and asking God, what is your wisdom for us in our working lives? As we get going here tonight, can you complete this sentence? It begins with these words. So little time. Complete the sentence. So little time. So much to do. Isn't it interesting that we know that phrase so well? Isn't it? It's such an interesting phrase. Maybe you think that often. Maybe you feel that way often. The thing is that all of us actually have the same amount of time. No one has access to more than 24 hours in a single day. No matter how rich you are, you cannot buy an extra minute of time. No matter how smart you are, you cannot invent an extra second of time. We all have the same amount of time. The real challenge is not about how much time do we have, it's what are we doing with the time that we have. Nevertheless, many of us are struggling with our relationship with time in our lives. Now, arguably, you and I today, living in the 21st century, we have more time than our ancestors did. That's interesting, because although we have more time, we're also more stressed than they were. It's really interesting because we have more disposable time because we have this army of slaves in our lives. They're called devices, labor-saving devices in our homes that do so many things that in the past our ancestors had to labor over for hours and days at a time. Take one of them, this one. Do you have one in your house? A washing machine. Washing clothes in days gone by would take hours of effort every single day to do. And now what you can do is you can start off in the morning, you can pile everything into the washing machine, you can put it on a cycle, and you can take it out later on. And even some of you have got one of these really fancy ones that will even dry it for you. And you just take it out at the end of the day and just fold it away. It's fabulous. Some of you can even save time, not even fold it, just throw it in the drawer. That's my style. So we have more time than our ancestors, and yet we are more stressed than our ancestors were. Also, we have this other strange phenomenon happening at the very same time alongside that, which is that we also struggle so much with procrastination. We complain we have so little time, so much to do, and yet we manage to fritter away so much of the time that we do have on meaningless, trivial things. How many of us have one of these that let's not even think about how much time sometimes this device can consume, mindlessly scrolling through the headlines, mindlessly looking a lot down the social media feed. So much time, so little time, so much to do, and yet we manage to waste so much time procrastinating. What is going on with our relationship with time? That's what I want us to think about together this evening. Now, various studies suggest that this is not all in our heads. It's not that just particularly my generation sometimes get called the snowflake generation. It's not just all in our heads, okay? The studies certainly suggest that it is really a phenomenon that today we are more stressed than days gone by. And the answer seems to be all tied in with our technology. Yes, it seems to save us lots of time, but it also adds a great deal of complexity into our lives. We are now more accessible to people than ever before. It used to be that someone had to send you a letter, and the letter had to get from you and to them, and that took time. Or it had to be that someone had to send you a telegram, and that required some time. And then people could phone you, but you had to be in to take the phone call. Or you had to have an answering machine, and you had to check the answering machine. Now someone can ping you an email. Now someone can send you a message on WhatsApp. And not only can you see the message has been sent, you also can see they've read it. Any of you enjoy playing that game? Oh, they've read my message and it's been 5 minutes and they haven't replied. I'm a slave to this. Isn't this interesting? We are more accessible to people than ever before, which has raised people's expectations of our speed of responding and dealing with the things that they are asking us and speaking to us about. Also, our devices make our work more accessible. So many of us got used to working remotely. Not, your work is not just waiting for you any longer in the office. You can access your office at home, remotely through the internet. We're also, through our devices and our technology, exposed to more opinions than ever before, more options than ever before. Life has just got an awful lot more complicated. Is it any wonder then that so many people are complaining that they are burning out with exhaustion or they're checking out in procrastination? Now, what all of that tells me is that we are in desperate need of God's wisdom for our working lives. We need God's wisdom if we're to avoid two fatal errors. One of them I'm calling being crazy lazy. The other one I'm calling being crazy busy. Now, these happen to be the name titles of two good books on this subject. I highly recommend them. They're also short, so another good reason to recommend them. But if we're going to avoid being crazy busy and crazy lazy in our lives, well, what is God's answer? What is God's wisdom for our working lives? And that's what we're going to try to find tonight here in Proverbs. And tonight we're going to meet a character in Proverbs called the sluggard. Now, he happens to be my favorite character in the book of Proverbs, so I'm delighted that I'm speaking on this. But I love the sluggard in so many ways. In many ways, I would like to be the sluggard, I think. But we'll talk more about that in a minute. Let's meet the sluggard in Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6, verses 6 down to verse 11, introduces us to this fascinating character. You read, God is speaking here. He says, "Go to the ant, O sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. So how long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man." Now, can I just be really honest with you and tell you that there are times whenever I really want to be envious of the sluggard. There are times whenever I wake up in the morning and I think to myself, wouldn't it be lovely just to be able to turn over, close my eyes, and go back to sleep, and not have to get up and get ready and get the kids organized and get them where they need to be and then get myself where I need to be. Wouldn't it be lovely just to roll over and go back to sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands. It sounds wonderful. And if you're anything like me, if that is you, well, this passage does not mean that you can't have a lie-in from time to time, okay? So don't think that. That's not what this passage is about. If we're going to interpret what Proverbs 6 says correctly, we need to understand a few things. We need to, first of all, understand God's intention for our work. Then we need to understand sin's distortion of our work. And then we need to finally think about the Christian's motivation in our work. When we've got all those pieces in place, we'll understand what God says here to the sluggard. So let's start with the first thing. Let's start with God's intention for work. And this passage that we've just read in Proverbs tells us that if we want to know what a wise worker looks like, then we need to go for a walk. And we need to go out in nature. And we need to bend down and find an ant. Now, I wonder, have you ever stopped long enough to watch an ant at work? They're impressive little things. Some years ago, Kirsten and I were having a hill-walking holiday in Greece, and one lunchtime we were up in a beautiful little village in the mountains, and we stopped for lunch in the village square, and we sort of sat in a step, and we're eating our sandwiches, and the crumbs are just liberally dropping from our hands down onto the floor, and suddenly we notice that all around our feet, the floor has just turned into this alive carpet of ants who are just working busily. They're just collecting all the little crumbs that we've dropped and just scurrying them away off to their holes nearby. And that day, I thought of this proverb, and I thought to myself, I better pay attention here, because God says, go and consider the ant. Go and observe it at work. Consider what it's teaching you. So here's a few things that you can learn about ants if you observe them. First thing is that ants are proactive. They're proactive. They're self-motivated. They don't need anyone to tell them to go and do something. They see a job, and they go to it. They go get the job done, all on their own. The bread came down, they got to work. Second thing to notice about ants is that they plan ahead. So they have this inbuilt instinct sense that they need to gather food in the spring and the summer because winter's coming. So they need to have food ready in advance. They plan ahead. Third thing, ants are diligent. They keep going. There was nothing but stopping these ants. They didn't just stop and just loiter around. No, these ants, they got to work and they kept going until the job was done and the floor was spotless. Another thing to notice about the ants is they work together. They're a team. When things get too heavy, they call on the help of others. So there's just four observations that you can draw from observing an ant at work. It's no wonder then that when God wants to give us an example, an illustration of a wise worker, God says, go find some ants. Go and watch them at work. What God wants the work-shy sluggard to see from the ant, the hard-working ant, is something that the sluggard is prone to forget. And that is that God has made human beings to be workers. He's built into the fabric of creation, he's built into the fabric of our existence, the need, the desire to work. Now, when I talk about work tonight, I'm looking out and I'm seeing people who are of different ages and stages. So I don't want you to hear the word work and think, okay, this message is not for me. Don't hear the word work and then assume that means paid employment or paid full-time employment. Work means much more than that. If you're retired, you're out of work, you're finished work, you've turned the page. Let me say, you're still a worker. Eric was saying the other week from the front that now he's retired a year, he's busier than he's ever been. Eric's a hard worker. And so there are loads of tasks, loads of responsibilities, maybe things you're volunteering in that make you a worker even when you are retired. Some of you are students. And you think, I'm the definition of someone who's not a worker. That's still ahead of me. But your mom and dad who are paying your fees maybe back home definitely think that your studies are your work, they're your vocation as you train and you prepare for your career in the future. Some of you maybe right now are out of work. You've faced redundancy and maybe you're looking for a job or you're retraining. But there are loads of things that you're doing to fill your time. You're a worker still. You're doing meaningful things with your time. You're a worker. Some of you watching at home, maybe you're a full-time stay-at-home mum, and you work harder than the rest of us do. You're workers too. And so workers, it's not just about full-time paid employment. God has made all human beings to be workers. We find that in Genesis. Back at the very beginning of the Bible, in the very story of creation, we read in Genesis chapter 1, God gives his first commission to the human race. God's first great commission is not to go into the world and preach the gospel. That's the second great commission. God's first great commission is sometimes called the cultural mandate. It is God's job description for humans, and it literally is a job description. God is giving us a job to do as human beings. In Genesis 1, verse 27, we read, so God created humanity in his own image. That'll be important in a minute. But he goes on and says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion. Be workers. Go and take the raw stuff that I have planted, the potentials in creation, and develop it. That's what we see happening in later chapters of Genesis. Farming's invented. Metalwork's invented. Musical instruments are invented. Culture is invented. Cities are built. That's the cultural mandate. Genesis chapter 2, again, we have a zoom in on the story of creation to when God creates the first man. In Genesis 2:15, we're told that the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. God has made human beings to be workers. That means every time you go out and you cut your grass, you're fulfilling the cultural mandate. Every time you clear the clutter in your dining room and you go and wash up in the kitchen, you're fulfilling the cultural mandate. You are bringing order to the chaos of your garden, bringing order to the chaos of your kitchen. You're being a worker. You're fulfilling your first great commission. And the reason that God has called human beings to work is because God himself is a worker. We've been made in the image of a God who is a worker. I find really helpful a book by Robert Banks that's called Faith Goes to Work. And in this, he tries to reflect on how God's work is reflected in our work. So, some examples. He points out God engages in creative work. That's why we have poets and artists, designers, architects, engineers. That's why some of us love Lego. We're made in the image of a God who is creative. God engages in providential work. That's organizing things, setting up systems, making things run on time and properly. That's why we have administrators, secretaries, HR managers, economists, financial advisors, caretakers, gardeners. God engages in justice work. That's why we've got lawyers and judges and police. God engages in restorative work. That's why we have plumbers, counselors, painters, cleaners. God engages in compassionate work. That's why we've got doctors, nurses, therapists, carers, nursery workers. God engages in revelatory work. That's why we have teachers, researchers, journalists, scientists. The list can go on. Where does your work fit into that? Which category would you put yourself in? Or your employment, if it's your employed work, where does it fit in there? Or your tasks, your daily tasks, the things that that consume your time, where do they fit in there? You work because you've been made in the image of a God who is a worker. So what all this tells us is that our work, our daily tasks and responsibilities, they are a good, glorious, God-given thing. And that means tomorrow morning when you wake up, when you go and turn to your to-do list, you can be like the seven dwarfs. You can sing to your heart's content, hi-ho, hi-ho. You know the song. It's off to work we go. I hope that rings out across Edinburgh tomorrow morning. I'll be listening. But don't worry, I know that's not going to happen tomorrow morning. I know that because I live in the real world too. And I know that Monday mornings are hard for a lot of us. There's a reason why they're hard. There's a reason why work feels like a burden. There's a reason why so often we feel the need to vent to people about our frustrations and the difficulties we face at work. Because God's intention for our work is not the end of the story. Let's move on to the second thing then. Let's think about sin's distortion of work. Today we don't live in that wonderful paradise that Adam and Eve, our first parents, lived in. Instead, we live in a fallen, sin-cursed world. A world that produces thorns and thistles that frustrates us in our work. That causes us to get stressed in our work. And sin often results in two common distorted ways of responding in our working lives. One is to be what I'm calling to be crazy lazy, and the other is to be crazy busy. Let's look at these two distortions of God's intention. First of all, let's think about being crazy lazy. This is the temptation of underworking. And this is the temptation that the sluggard in Proverbs embodies. The sluggard is someone who idolizes a life of ease and escape. And I think actually we live in a society that, rather than criticize the sluggard, celebrates the sluggard. Some of our celebrities, some of the big name people in our society, they are famous for being famous. And their work seems to consist in maintaining their fame and drawing attention to themselves, but not really doing anything else of meaningful value. We are in a society that celebrates the sluggard. The sluggard would be on the pedestal if he was here today. Our world, it values the pursuit of pleasure over the carrying the burden of responsibility. And you know, some of that in our world has seeped into us. Many of us have sluggard tendencies. We have nurtured, we have fed, we have discipled ourselves in sluggardy tendencies. Listen to some of the descriptions in Proverbs of the sluggard. We don't just meet him here in chapter 6. We meet him in various other places. Here's what Proverbs tells us what he's like. First thing to see is the sluggard is a bit of a nightmare to work with. He doesn't follow instructions. He doesn't pull his weight. Proverbs 10:26, like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the sluggard to those who send him. Proverbs 20, verse 4 tells us that the sluggard is useless, hopeless at getting things done on time. The sluggard does not plow in the autumn. He will seek at harvest and have nothing. This is the guy who misses his deadlines, gets nothing done on time, always runs late. Next one, the sluggard always has an excuse for not starting things. I think this is my favorite one of them all. Proverbs 22, verse 13. The sluggard says, there's a lion outside. I shall be killed in the streets, so I better stay in my bed. That's a great one. Try that one tomorrow morning. The lion outside. It's escape from the zoo. Has an excuse for not starting things. The counterpart to that one is this next one, which is the sluggard doesn't finish the things he starts. And again, this is probably my second equal favorite of them all. 26:15. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. Just picture this. He buries his hand in the dish. It wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. Who is this guy? Next one, the sluggard loves his bed too much. 26:14, as a door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. He loves the snooze button. Didn't exist back then, but he would have loved the snooze button. And here's the climax of it all, 21:25. We're warned here that the sluggard's laziness, it's funny, but it's also tragic. 21:25, the desire of the sluggard kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. You have to wonder, how did this guy get here? How does the sluggard get here? I don't think this was his plan. I don't think he met the school's career advisor and said, you know what, when I grow up, I really want to be a sluggard. Instead, chapter 6 tells us how he got here. Chapter 6, verse 10. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. It's just all the little compromises, just all the little surrenders, just all the little things he lets slide. But they all added up to a wasted life. It's like what would happen each day if you were to ingest just a tiny bit of arsenic poison. It's not going to kill you, not immediately, but it will be stored in your body. And gradually over the days and over the weeks and over the months, it will build up until it reaches fatal concentration, and then it will strike you down dead. All the little compromises. That's how the sluggard got here. All these little habits of procrastinating. And Proverbs disarms us by making us laugh at the sluggard. And then comes the sucker punch. That the sluggard is actually in an awful lot of us, if not all of us. These tendencies are in my heart. I suspect they're in your heart. So why is it that we don't do what we ought to do? Why is it that we don't do what we ought to do when we ought to have done it? Maybe there are various reasons. It might be due to anxiety. Research seems to suggest that procrastination is a depressive response to anxiety. Life just feels too much, and so you just check out. Just put it off entirely. You just can't face doing anything. So maybe it's anxiety, shuts you down, causes you to check out. Maybe it's a fear of failure. Because if you never start something, well, then you can't fail, can you? Maybe it's due to a lack of discipline. Maybe it's due to a desire for comfort and not wanting to experience discomfort. These four things, they're explanations, but they're not justifications. Proverbs warns us through the character of the sluggard that we must not excuse our laziness. We must not excuse our procrastination. It is sinful. It is foolishness. It is a throwing away of the life that God has given us, the precious life that Jesus has redeemed at the cost of his own blood. The sluggard is exhorted here, verse 9, when will you get up? And he's warned, verse 11, because if you don't, poverty will come upon you. It will destroy you. Now, please don't misread Proverbs. Proverbs is not against you having a rest. Proverbs is not against you having a lion. Proverbs is not against you enjoying some recreation. That's not the problem here. Instead, Proverbs is warning us that laziness will not only ruin your work and ruin your life in the end, But it will also ruin your leisure. You will not be able to appreciate and enjoy your rest and recreation time unless you are deploying yourself fully in your work, in your working time. Just as gorging on a good thing like honey makes you sick, gorging on just rest and leisure and pleasure instead of your responsibilities, it will make you sick. And you will not be able to enjoy your rest time when it comes. And so we learn here that we were not made to coast through life effortlessly. Instead, God has made us for so much more. He has made us to work and have responsibility and find pleasure and meaning in our working lives. He's made us to be workers, not to be sluggards. That's one sinful distortion. It's the temptation of underworking. But there's another side to this. And it's the sinful temptation of being crazy busy. This is the temptation of overworking. And this is actually another very culturally acceptable form of responding to the curse of sin in our world. And I think even in our churches, this is a very culturally acceptable sin. I find it very interesting that when someone asks, "How are you? How are you doing?" so often my instinctive response is, "Oh, I'm busy." Why do I want you to know that? Why am I saying that? Busyness sometimes for some of us is a badge of honor. And I think for some of us here tonight, our problem is not laziness, it's busyness. But workaholism is not healthy. I looked up some statistics this last week, and the UK Statistics Authority reported that last year, 17 million days were lost due to stress and anxiety in the workplace. The TUC, the Trade Unions Congress, reports that every 2 minutes, someone is made sick by stress at work. Workaholism is hurting us. With those sorts of statistics in mind, Proverbs would counsel us to stop and just to examine our lives, to question what's going on in our busyness. Get us to examine and ask some questions of ourselves, like, what are my responsibilities? What am I meant to be doing with my time? What does God expect me to be doing with my life? You see, I think it's possible to be a busy sluggard, to be busy doing the wrong things, to be consumed with doing lesser important things and neglecting the important things that God has called us to and has given us as our responsibilities. That's a danger. So we need to reflect and consider, what are my responsibilities? What is God calling me to do with my time? And am I giving those things their weight? Or am I frittering away my time in busyness things and in doing good things, but not the right things? What are my responsibilities? Another question to reflect on is, what are the legitimate expectations I can have of myself and I can allow others to have of me, particularly at this stage in my life? What can I expect of myself? What can others expect of me? Sometimes we're driven by other people's expectations. Not God's expectations, but we're driven by other people's expectations. And they can drive us into the ground. Another question to consider is, what's my motivation in doing so much? We and I were talking about this week after listening to something else, and a question that someone was asking, which is, what is driving our drivenness? What is it that makes us work so hard and so much to our own harm and detriment? What is going on? You've often heard me talk to you about this little book by Tim Chester called The Busy Christian's Guide to Busyness. I like this book. I read this book 20 years ago, and I think I need to go and reread it again. What I love about this book is that it makes us ask the question, why? Why am I doing what I do? What is going on? What are my motivations? What are some of the lies that lurk in my heart driving me to overwork? Lies like, I'm busy because I need to prove myself. I'm busy because I'm afraid of what others will think of me. I'm busy because I'm anxious that unless I keep everything in my hands and under control, things will get out of control. I'm busy because I need the money. These are lies that can drive us to overwork. And if we're going to be set free from the lies, if we're going to be saved from overwork, crazy busyness, then we need to fight the lies with the truth. the truth that we find revealed in the person of Jesus Christ. His life, his example. Jesus was no sluggard, but Jesus was no workaholic. Jesus is a man on a mission. Literally, he's the God-man on a mission. But the interesting thing is, so many people notice this, Jesus never is recorded in all gospel, on any of the gospels, as running. Never runs. He's never in a rush. Jesus has so many things to do. He has only 3 years to do it. 3 years of ministry to save the world. 3 short years. He has all of these people all day, all the time around him, wanting things from him. And yet Jesus never runs. He's never rushed. He's able to actually say no to some people. And in Christ, I think we can find the wisdom we need, the secret to walking this tightrope between being crazy busy and crazy lazy, to avoiding these two sinful distortions of God's plan and design for our work. So let's move on. We've thought about God's design for our work. We've thought about sin's distortion of our work. And now I want us to wind up and think about the Christian's motivation in our work. And here we just want to spend some time with Jesus and get some wisdom from him. Jesus once said, someone greater than Solomon is here. Solomon in Proverbs, he was a wise guy. He was the wisest guy who ever lived until Jesus came. Jesus is wisdom incarnate. Jesus understands and can show us how we can live wisely in our working lives. So there's two things here I want to think about. I want to think about how Jesus is good news, first of all, for the overworking. And I want us to think about how Jesus is good news for the underworking. So Jesus is good news for the overworking. Now maybe you're here tonight and you're dreading tomorrow. Let's put it lightly. You're exhausted, you're overwhelmed, you're dreading it. I want you to listen to these words from Jesus in Matthew 11. So beautiful words. Jesus says, come to me. Come to me. You who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. If you're overworking, if you are dreading tomorrow and what this week holds for you, Jesus says to you, stop. Come to me. Understand who I am. Understand what is at the heart of me. Because I'm not a slave driver. You can come to me and stop and rest and be refreshed. And understand that you've got nothing you have to prove. Not to me, not to my Father in heaven. Nothing to prove, nothing to earn. I want to set you free from the relentless pursuit of success. I want to free you from the lurking fear of failure. This life, your eternal life, it doesn't depend on your performance. You have nothing to earn, nothing to prove. Rest on me, Jesus says. Come to me, rest, stop, reassess. Jesus empowers you to say no to some things and to some people, so you can say yes to the God-given people and things in your life. Jesus gives you permission to slow down. He gives you permission to rest. Jesus says, come and learn from me. He says, come to me, come and rest. And he says, come and learn from me as well. Come and learn about life at my pace. Come and learn to do life with me at my pace. Yes, God's made us to be workers, but he's not made us to work 24/7. Yes, God's made us to be workers, but he's not made us to be slaves. He's made us to be sons and daughters. Come and learn from me. Come and share my rest, and then come with me to work at my pace. Jesus is good news for the overworkers among us. He makes this beautiful invitation, come to me. And Jesus is also good news for the underworking. He provides good motivations for the underworking. And maybe you're here tonight and you feel acutely the sting of the sluggard. Yes, he's funny, but maybe you recognize actually the portrait fits you a little bit too much. Maybe you recognize a little bit too much of the sluggard in you. And the worst thing you could do tonight is to hear the message of the sluggard, to hear that it's sinful and that God is not pleased with the sluggard, then to go out of here feeling guilty, feeling ashamed, and thinking, I just need to go and pull myself together and work harder this week. That would not be optimal. That's not what I want you to go and do after this message. I want you to understand how Jesus gives you better motivations for going to your work this week. We find that in Colossians chapter 3. Here, the Apostle Paul is speaking to workers. He's actually speaking to slaves. Being a slave wasn't a great job, but there were many Christian slaves in the first century in the early church. And here's some instructions that Paul gives to the slaves who do the hard menial work in the house. He says, Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Jesus, you are serving the Lord Christ. For the wrongdoer, the sluggard, will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. What this passage tells us then is that when we are working, yes, whether we're working in paid employment for our bosses or whether we're doing our other tasks for other people, fulfilling our other responsibilities, when we work, we're not just working for men, we're not just working for ourselves, we're not just working to put food on the table and clothes on our backs and shoes on our feet and petrol in the car. No, we're working for God. Always, our work is part of our worship and service of God. There's a story told about a scullery maid who worked in one of those big old Victorian mansions. Think Downtown Abbey. She works downstairs in the kitchens. And the scullery maid's job was to mop the floors, sweep the floors, wash up all the washing, all the pots and pans and things like that. She was the dishwasher. But above the sink in this scullery maid's kitchen, or washroom, whatever it was called, she had this little sign, this little plaque. And it read, divine service is done at this sink daily. You see, she understood what this verse teaches. That she's not just washing up plates and pots and pans and forks and knives. She's not just washing up things. She's serving God. Divine service is offered at that altar, at that washing, at that sink, that washing station. Divine service. Her work matters to God. And knowing that, she made sure that those plates were spotless. Not just because she would get in trouble if they weren't, but because she's serving God. She wants to give God her best. The same is true of us and all the tasks that we do. Our work is part of our worship. Our work matters in the sight of God. He can be pleased with our work. Dare I also say then he can be displeased by our poor work. We want to give him our best. We want to serve him well. We want to serve our neighbors well, because that's what we're doing in our work. We are loving our neighbors through our work. We're also fulfilling our root basic commission as human beings. We are helping to bring order to the chaos of this world through our work. There are many good reasons to do your work. But above all, the crown of them all is that we are serving God. And there's a promise here in this text that there will be a reward. You know, there are people in our lives, there are people in this world, we have bosses, we have people in our lives, and they don't appreciate us. They don't see the good work that we do. They don't appreciate the hard work that we do. They don't see what goes on in the hidden secret place. But there's a God in heaven who sees it. There's a God in heaven who will one day reward you for it. Richly and fully. So whatever it is you're going out to do this week, wherever you're doing it, whether you're volunteering here in the church, whether you're out there in the workplace, whether you're at home with the children, maybe you're caring for elderly relatives, whether you're doing something that's very mundane, something that's extraordinary, whatever is your work this week, whatever is your work tomorrow morning, whatever is that top item on your to-do list, I want you to have in your mind the scullery maid's little plaque. Divine service is done here daily. That is divine service. That work, it is worship. You can dedicate your work to God. Say, Lord, take this. Be pleased with this. Be honored by this. Be glorified in this. And you can offer it to God knowing that he will reward you one day for your faithfulness. One day you'll hear him say, well done, good and faithful servant. I love the clean plates. I love the changed nappies. I love the lessons well taught. I love the buildings well designed. I love the patients well tended to. I love the lessons well taught. I'm looking around the room and I'm starting to fail. I love the AV working spotlessly. I love the music being played wonderfully and the flute solo. It's all worship. And so that's us tonight. We've been thinking about God's design for our work, his intention for our work. We've been thinking about sin's distortion of our work and the two forms it takes, being crazy busy, being crazy lazy. And then we thought about the Christian's motivation in our work, that Jesus is good news if we are overworking. And that Jesus supplies us with good motivations if we're underworking. One piece of homework for you tonight. Your job this week is to go out for a walk, find an ant, and get down and watch it and pray, Lord, teach me to be a wise worker like this ant. Save me from being crazy busy and crazy lazy. I will be asking you next week. The meadows is 10 minutes that way.